Welcome to the State of Sound podcast, produced by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. A companion series to the blockbuster exhibit, The State of Sound, a world of music from Illinois.
Welcome to the State of Sound podcast. I'm Lance Tauser from the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, and I am the curator and producer of the exhibit, The State of Sound. This episode is with Martin Atkins. Martin is a drummer, artist, author, educator, and entrepreneur, and is originally from Coventry in England. His music career has spanned over 40 years. He has played with bands such as Public Image Limited, Nine Inch Nails, Pig Face, Killing Joke, Revolting Cocks, Murder, Inc., Brian Brain, and many others. Martin has been a tremendous advocate for teaching and inspiring musicians and music industry people to become professionals, to learn from his own experience. Martin has written both the books Band Smart and Tour Smart, and has recently opened the Museum of Post-Punk and Industrial Music in Chicago. Full disclosure, I'm one of his advisors. And he has recently been inducted as a fellow of In Place of War, which is a global organization that uses creativity in places of conflict as a tool for positive change. Martin, thank you for being a part of this exhibit, The State of Sound, and thanks for doing this podcast.
Well, thanks for having me. It was a beautiful exhibit. Was it just a few weeks ago I was down there? Just really great. Congratulations.
Yeah, we had a reception. I really kind of loved the mixture of people that was there. You know, yourself included, of course, the guys from the Shoes, Eddie Blazonczyk's family, the Polka King. You had, Howlin' Wolf's daughter was there. It was a real melting pot. It was, I specifically loved seeing you and John Langford sitting around a table because, it's funny because you and he, John Langford is a Welshman who came to Chicago, different type of music. He was a punk rocker though. Before he came. So maybe there was some parallels there. You and he are about the same age and you had this sort of similar journey to Chicago.
Well, I sat in a pub, in the back room of a pub in Leeds. I just joined Public Image. Members of the Gang of Four were there. The Mekons were there. John Langford was there. Members of a band called Delta Five. And, we all have smartphones now, and there would have been 100 pictures if we did that today. I don't think there's a single picture of that moment. That would be 1979, maybe 1980. And now here we are in Chicago. It's crazy.
Yeah. This whole exhibit that we did was essentially, an opportunity for us to sort of make a case, if you will, that Chicago has offered the world, and Illinois, we kind of brought it to Illinois, but, Illinois has offered the world some incredible music, some incredible musicians. Some of them were born here and raised here, and some of them came here, like Muddy Waters and who came from the South and Buddy Guy and people who came from other countries as well, like yourself. So my long-winded first question is, how did you find yourself relocating and tell me a little bit about your career track that sort of found its way here and why?
Well, okay. Well, so here's my long-winded answer to your long-winded question. So I was living in the north of England, from age 8 to maybe 16 when punk rock happened. And, punk was a revolution. It was anti people spending 10 hours a day practicing their instrument. It was just like, here's an instrument, go, start a band. And of course there was lots of care and respect to some aspects. But it was a revolution, and I wanted to be close to the heat, in the heat.
Essentially, an opportunity for us to sort of make a case, if you will, that Chicago has offered the world, and Illinois, we kind of brought it to Illinois, but Illinois has offered the world some incredible music, some incredible musicians. Some of them were born here and raised here, and some of them came here, like Muddy Waters and who came from the South and Buddy Guy and people who came from other countries as well, like yourself. So my long-winded first question is, you know, how did you find yourself relocating? And tell me a little bit about your career track that sort of found its way here and why.
So here's my long-winded answer to your long-winded question. So I was living in the north of England, you know, from age 8 to maybe 16 when punk rock happened. And, you know, punk was a revolution. It was anti people spending 10 hours a day practicing their instrument. It was just like, here's an instrument, go, start a band. And of course, there was lots of care and respect to some aspects. But it was a revolution. And I wanted to be close to the heat in London. In London, people spending 10 hours a day practicing their instrument. It was just like, here's an instrument, go, start a band. And of course, there was lots of care and respect to some aspects. But it was a revolution. And I wanted to be close to the heat in London. And so, you know, I ended up joining a band with Johnny Rotten. I don't know how much closer to the heat I could have gotten.
That's pretty close.
So then, you know, with Public Image Limited, came over to the States. We toured. We went around the world. Ended up moving to New York City, then to Los Angeles. And then on my travels, I saw what was happening in Chicago. And it was definitely on my radar. I was living in New Jersey for a while after Manhattan and Los Angeles. And I knew what was happening with Wax Trax, the label.
Yes.
The Revolting Cox, Ministry, Big Black, Steve Albini, Touch and Go.
Oh, yeah.
I was aware of the Metro and all of these clubs. And it didn't take much. You know, Al asked me to get involved with Ministry.
Al Jorgensen.
Yeah. And I think I was at Steve Albini's birthday party. I met Corey from Touch and Go. And I just knew this was where the energy was happening, and just moved out here. So it was through experience, but also, you know, I spent time in Times Square. You know, I'm not saying I lived in Manhattan, but really I lived 2 hours outside of Manhattan. I was in the center of Manhattan, and I lived in Los Angeles. But there's an energy about Chicago. Aside from the industrial music and the experimentation, there was a collaboration between everybody. There was what I take to be a Midwestern roll up your sleeves and make it happen, which is different than New York, just like, oh dear, this isn't happening, let's go somewhere else, or LA. I don't know what the LA attitude was. But Chicago was definitely like, well, the sound system's blown up, let's make another one. Right. You know, let's just do it. And I experienced that time and time again. And we really thrived here as myself as an artist and my record label Invisible.
Right.
I started my recording studio here. I bought Steve Albini's studio when he went from 8-track to 24-track and came over to help wire things up. I mean, just great things, just great things.
Well, I think you kind of made my case there, because you basically, you know, Chicago has always had this sort of chip on its shoulder that New York and LA, you know, have this thing going on. And you know, I'd like to make the case that Midwest sensibility is a driving force, because nobody's going to make it for you. And that seemed to center around about the time. About what year would you say you sort of ended up and sort of planted roots in Chicago?
late 88, early 89.
Right. I mean, that was a very pivotal point, wasn't it?
Yeah.
All of those record labels you just mentioned, all of those bands, the scene, clubs like the Metro and a bunch of others that were openly letting these touring bands through, but also fostering a scene to grow. Obviously a lot of great artists, sort of came out of the ground here that originated from that area. But so, yeah, let's talk a little bit about Invisible Records too, because it's probably when I first met you a long time ago, you had quite an operation going, and I can't remember. You'll have to remind me about where it was in the city because my brain is very foggy. But you had a lot of people working there. You had a lot. You had promotions and tours. And you were releasing records, and you were doing all this kind of stuff, in a very do-it-yourself way. It was quite an organization. So tell me a little bit about, how Invisible Records came to be, and all the things that happened.
Well, it was quite wild. And if you remember the huge Invisible logo on the wall as you walked in, I cut that wall out when we left. It's over at the museum. So we had 8,500 square feet of warehouse space at 2024 South Wabash. The building was kind of deserted. And we had no clue. I think I negotiated with the landlords. Give me $400 off my first month's rent. It was only $1,000 a month. We need $400 for paint. Well, and I thought, yeah, I win because I got $400 for paint. I realized pretty quickly I really needed like $1,200 for paint. I mean, it was a huge, huge space. But aside from having the space to spread out and be creative, I built like 1,000 square foot floating soundproof room for Killing Joke. I was in Killing Joke at the time, and I was flying over to London to rehearse. And it was particularly difficult for me because Killing Joke is a very physical band. So I'd play for 4 or 5 hours and then have to get a tube train to a bus to another tube, a 2-hour commute to get home, and exhausted. Just to turn around and do it again.
Yeah.
And at the loft we had on Wabash, I built this room floating on rubber tubing filled with sand. And my commute home was 30 feet. And I, after a day rehearsing, I was this, up to my nose in a bathtub. Right. Once we built that room, it was easy to take advantage when Albini went 24 track. I put his tape machines and his mixing console into the closet off to the side of there.
Right.
Just as a kind of a pre-production demo facility. Hmm. But once digital audio started to come of age, we added stereo editing digitally, then 4-track recording, and then ADATs and started to build up that room to a point where it became my studio. I started to make albums there. Yeah. And I was able to let Swans, Lard, Killing Joke and Pigface and Murder, Inc. And yourselves rehearse and do pre-production in there. We were able to have 10 people working there, interns, screen printing, equipment storage, and it really became a hub of operations.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I'm generally impressed. Obviously, we had a mutual friend, the producer we were working with, Clowne, obviously worked with you on Public Image Limited's Flowers of Romance, right?
And yeah.
So That was really quite a unique experience. So if you give me the really short version of 1979, you're in Public Image Limited, and you've had all these experiences with these bands. Can you kind of connect the dots from 1979 to more or less present day and the people that you've kind of jumped in, the bands that you've formed yourself and the ones that you've become a member of? How do you connect those dots leading to where we are? Is that too long of a list?
No, let me see if I can do it. So I was a member of Public Image Limited for 5 years. Right. I was a member of Killing Joke for 2 years. I formed the Damage Manual, Murder, Inc., and Pig Face. And then I contributed to Nine Inch Nails, Ministry, Revolting Cocks, etc. So the Public Image Killing Joke certainly gave me the credibility from 79 onwards to be on the cutting edge of that avant-garde post-punk movement. And then, you know, by creating Pigface on my own label, the 600 or 700 people in Pigface, it's a natural Rolodex, if I can use a really old term that people can look up on. Yeah. It's just this, you know. And but then, so using all of that with the memorabilia I've accumulated to create the museum felt like an end to, you know, an ending point. And it turns out that it's a beginning point.
Right.
You know, Igor Cavalera, who co-founded Sepultura, the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, Nick Mason from Pink Floyd, his guys came over.
Yeah.
It's this crazy, what's that dating app, Bumble? It's like Bumble on steroids for musicians and people who like fashion and art and DIY. So I think all of this stuff feels quite naturally to come together through the museum.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. So, you know, it's interesting. So we're both now in the museum field. That's kind of feeling quite coming full circle. Take me there. You had amassed a lot of materials over the period of time. You had done a fair amount of outreach to the music community saying, I've got this idea about founding a museum. You know, from, you know, the moment you had the idea to when you more or less opened it to say, I've got to, you know, walk me through that process of what you did and how you pulled it together.
Well, it's pretty punk. So I announced April 21st, 2021. And you've seen it. We need a new building. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. I
think it was a week from when. I think the idea had been percolating. I would advise bands just as a mindset to start a museum of themselves, either physically or in their head, so that they would have a different, more longevity in their strategies. Like, yeah, this, it might not make sense to have this poster now, but you'll be pleased you did a 3-screen custom signed and numbered poster 10 years from now, 15 years from now, 15 years from now.
In the bands that you've formed yourself and the ones that you've become a member of, how do you connect those dots leading to where we are? Is that too long of a list?
No, let me see if I can do it. So I was a member of Public Image Limited for 5 years.
Right.
I was a member of Killing Joke for 2 years. I formed the Damage Manual, Murder, Inc., and Pig Face. And then I contributed to Nine Inch Nails, Ministry, Revolting Cocks, etc. So the Public Image Killing Joke certainly gave me the credibility from 79 onwards to be on the cutting edge of that avant-garde post-punk movement. And then, you know, by creating Pigface on my own label, the 600 or 700 people in Pigface, it's a natural Rolodex, if I can use a really old term that people can look up on.
Yeah.
It's just this, you know. And but then, so using all of that with the memorabilia I've accumulated to create the museum felt like an ending point. And it turns out that it's a beginning point.
Right.
You know, Igor Cavalera, who co-founded Sepultura, the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, Nick Mason from Pink Floyd, his guys came over.
Yeah.
It's this crazy, what's that dating app, Bumble? It's like Bumble on steroids. For musicians and people who like fashion and art and, right. and DIY. So I think all of this stuff feels quite naturally to come together through the museum.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. So, you know, it's interesting. So we're, you know, we're both now in the museum field. That's kind of feeling quite coming full circle. So yeah, take me there. You had amassed a lot of materials over the period of time. You had done a fair amount of outreach to the music community saying, I've got this idea about founding a museum. You know, from, you know, the moment you had the idea to when you more or less opened it to say, I've got to, you know, walk me through that process of what you did and how you pulled it together.
Well, it's pretty punk. So I announced April 21st, 2021. And you've seen it. We need to do a building. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I think it was a week from when. I think the idea had been percolating. I would advise bands just as a mindset to start a museum of themselves, either physically or in their head, so that they would have a different, more longevity in their strategies. Like, yeah, this, it might not make sense to have this poster now, but you'll be pleased you did a 3-screen custom signed and numbered poster 10 years from now, 15 years from now, 15 years from now.
Idea to when you more or less opened it to say, I've got to, you know, walk me through that process of what you did and how you pulled it together.
Well, it's pretty punk. So I announced April 21st, 2021. And you've seen it. We need to do a building. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I think it was a week from when. I think the idea had been percolating. I would advise bands just as a mindset to start a museum of themselves, either physically or in their head, so that they would have a different, more longevity in their strategies. Like, yeah, this, it might not make sense to have this poster now, but you'll be pleased you did a 3-screen custom signed and numbered poster 10 years from now, 15 years from now, 15 years from now. They would have a different, more longevity in their strategies. Like, yeah, this, it might not make sense to have this poster now, but you'll be pleased you did a 3-screen custom signed and numbered poster 10 years from now, 15 years from now, 15 years from now, signed and numbered poster 10 years from now, 15 years from now, 15 years from now, 15 years from now. So I guess I planted the seed in my own head. And then there's a little bit of Nipsey Hussle, the $100 mixtape.
Right.
I like this as a yardstick. It wasn't, I didn't at any point think I should open a museum, but I definitely thought if I don't try this, I'm going to regret not doing it. I had the space, I had the accumulation of all of this stuff.
Right.
And that felt like a really good starting point. So I announced, hey, if you want to buy this special t-shirt for $125, that makes you a founder, you can come visit.
Right.
And that's it. It just exploded. And that, I think something else I did by accident, I'm always conscious that fans of the music I've made over the last 45 years might not have money anymore.
Right.
They might have medical bills or who knows what's going on. So I always try and come up with an alternate way of doing stuff. So I said, if you don't have $125 for the founder's shirt, you could suggest an item of significance that you want to donate, and maybe that will make you a founder. And it just unlocked the floodgates of people with Paulie Gladden stopped by with 30 T-shirts in two carrier bags. People are sending me stuff. People are becoming founders by buying the shirt and then sending me stuff, then sending me more stuff. It really has exploded outside of my own personal Rolodex, to use that phrase. And the Skinny Puppy area, the Genesis PRH Psychic TV area, Einstürzende Neubauten area, all of these areas are just multiplying under their own steam, it seems.
Well, you bring up something that you kind of teed up my next question was, you have been a person who has multiple different interests and talents and stuff, but there's always been seemingly this theme of either teaching, educating, giving back, and collaborating. Obviously, you know, having 600 members of a band, that's a lot of collaboration. Part of what you've done is write a couple books, the Band Smart and Tour Smart. Tell me a little bit about how that came about, and then we'll kind of jump to Columbia College and Milliken.
Well, I'd love to say, and write about 2007, the next piece of my jigsaw puzzle, but it's all been accidents. But just to blow my own horn, I think my radar is always on, you know. So I went to Columbia to get some interns to help with some of the tours we were putting together, because we didn't trust promoters to do anything. If they did, it was a pleasant surprise. And we needed people to stuff envelopes and put stickers on things. And so I went to Columbia to get interns. And I know you asked me about the book. I'm getting there. And so I did a little presentation for the staff at Columbia, and somebody said to me, well, when could you start? And I said, well, I can start now. I can take interns to my label now. And they're like, no, when could you start teaching? And I'm like, teaching what? They're like, well, the business of touring. This is what you're doing. I'm like, well, it's what I've done all my life.
Right.
And I thought the crazy, you know, I left school when I was 16. I have my master's degree now. But I just thought the craziest, most punk thing I could do would be to say yes. Uh-huh. And so so I said yes, but I walked into the first class, which was only a few weeks later, and I said, okay, who's got the textbook? And somebody hands me this book written in 1962. And I'm like, what is this? Like, well, this is our textbook. And so my first question was to the students. I'm like, you're paying to be taught touring, which keeps changing, from a book written in 1962, like, pay attention, you know. If this was a meal, you'd send it back. So I just started to write my own book, and I thought that was a pretty interesting opportunity. It became an Amazon Music Business bestseller, but then I started to get asked to speak all over the world, based on Tour Smart. I mean, I found this most unexpected love of teaching, but also teaching is the way that I actually learned about what I was doing. So I'd pull in the latest things I was working on and talk them through, pull up a spreadsheet, look at the logistics, explain my trepidation here and there. And in doing so, started to really make concrete some of these seat of the pants ideas that we were throwing around. And then I started to develop a music business curriculum, because there wasn't much of that anywhere. And teaching in some other programs like Loyola down in New Orleans, and going out to USC to speak out there, and getting to know what other programs were doing. And then I think maybe 6 years ago, kind of fell in love with the challenge of Decatur at Millikan University. And it's a great school of music and a beautiful campus down there. And a city with some interesting challenges that we're still working on.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously my museum that I'm currently at is in Central Illinois as well. So I'm very familiar with the culture. When you get outside of Chicago, the culture of the state changes significantly.
Yeah.
So I would imagine that. So if I was a student at Millikan, what would I learn? What would you be teaching me?
Well, okay, without getting flowery, hopefully you get that 1,000-yard stare of an industry veteran. Mm-hmm. So we try and put, I call them big shiny objects. We run our own conference there called Midwest Music Expo.
Right.
Students put it together, and it attracts people to also solve some problems in Decatur. It's starting to attract people to Decatur and celebrate local businesses. We've taken students on the road in their own tour bus. Wendy Day was a mentor on one of the buses, and students helped set up. So I guess I planted the seed in my own head. And then there's a little bit of Nipsey Hussle, the $100 mixtape. Right. I like this as a yardstick. I didn't at any point think I should open a museum, but I definitely thought, if I don't try this, I'm going to regret not doing it. I had the space, I had the accumulation of all of this stuff.
Right.
And that felt like a really good starting point. So I announced, hey, if you want to buy this special t-shirt for $125, that makes you a founder, you can come visit.
Right.
And that's it. It just exploded. And that, I think something else I did by accident, I'm always conscious that fans of the music I've made over the last 45 years might not have money anymore.
Right.
They might have medical bills or who knows what's going on. So I always try and come up with an alternate way of doing stuff. So I said, if you don't have $125 for the founder's shirt, you could suggest an item of significance that you want to donate, and maybe that will make you a founder. And it just unlocked the floodgates of people with Paulie Gladden stopped by with 30 t-shirts in two carrier bags. People are sending me stuff. People are becoming founders by buying the shirt and then sending me stuff, then sending me more stuff. It really has exploded outside of my own personal Rolodex, to use that phrase, and the Skinny Puppy area, the Genesis PRH Psychic TV area, Einstürzende Neubauten area. All of these areas are just multiplying under their own steam, it seems.
Well, you bring up something that kind of teed up my next question. Was you have been a person who has multiple different interests and talents and stuff, but there's always been seemingly this theme of either teaching, educating, giving back, and collaborating. Obviously, you know, having 600 members of a band, you have, that's a lot of collaboration. You part of what you've done is write a couple books, the Band Smart and Tour Smart. Tell me a little bit about how that came about, and then we'll kind of jump to Columbia College and Millikan.
Well, I'd love to say, and write about 2007, the next piece of my jigsaw puzzle, but it was just, it's all been accidents. But in just to blow my own horn, I think my radar is always on, mm-hmm. you know. So I went to Columbia to get some interns to help with some of the tours we were putting together, because we didn't trust promoters to do anything. If they did, it was a pleasant surprise. And we needed people to stuff envelopes and put stickers on things. And so I went to Columbia to get interns. And I know you asked me about the book. I'm getting it. And so I did a little presentation for the staff at Columbia. And somebody said to me, well, when could you start? And I said, well, I can start now. I can take interns to my label now. And they're like, no, when could you start teaching? And I'm like, teaching what? Like, well, the business of touring. This is what you're doing. I'm like, well, it's what I've done all my life.
Right.
And I thought the crazy, you know, I left school when I was 16. I have my master's degree now. But I just thought the craziest, most punk thing I could do would be to say yes. Uh-huh. And so so I said yes, but I walked into the first class, which was only a few weeks later. And I said, okay, who's got the textbook? And somebody hands me this book written in 1962. And I'm like, what is this? Like, well, this is our textbook. And so my first question was to the students. I'm like, you're paying to be taught touring, which keeps changing, from a book written in 1962? Like, pay attention, you know. If this was a meal, you'd send it back. So I just started to write my own book. And I thought that was a pretty interesting opportunity. It became an Amazon Music Business bestseller. But then I started to get asked to speak all over the world,
right,
based on TourSmart. So, I mean, I found this most unexpected love of teaching, but also teaching is the way that I actually learned about what I was doing. So I'd pull in the latest things I was working on and talk them through, pull up a spreadsheet, look at the logistics, explain my trepidation here and there, and in doing so started to really make concrete some of these seat of the pants ideas that we were throwing around. And then I started to develop a music business curriculum, because there wasn't much of that anywhere, and teaching in some other programs like Loyola down in New Orleans, and going out to USC to speak out there, and getting to know what other programs were doing. And then I think maybe 6 years ago, kind of fell in love with the challenge of Decatur and Millikan University. And it's a great school of music and a beautiful campus down there. And a city with some interesting challenges that we're still working on.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously my museum that I'm currently at is in Central Illinois as well. So I'm very familiar with the culture. When you get outside of Chicago, the culture of the state changes significantly.
Yeah.
So I would imagine that. So if I was a student at Millikan, what would I learn? What would you be teaching me?
Well, okay, without getting flowery, hopefully you get that 1,000-yard stare of an industry veteran. Mm-hmm. So we try and put, I call them big shiny objects. We run our own conference there called Midwest Music Expo.
Right.
Students put it together, and it attracts people to also solve some problems in Decatur. It's starting to attract people to Decatur and celebrate local businesses. We've taken students on the road in their own tour bus. Wendy Day was a mentor on one of the buses, and cool. Students helped set up. So I guess I planted the seed in my own head. And then there's a little bit of Nipsey Hussle, the $100 mixtape.
Right.
I like this as a yardstick. I didn't at any point think I should open a museum, but I definitely thought, if I don't try this, I'm going to regret not doing it. I had the space. I had the accumulation of all of this stuff.
Right.
And that felt like a really good starting point. So I announced, hey, if you want to buy this special T-shirt for $125, that makes you a founder, you can come visit.
Right.
And that's it. It just exploded. And I think something else I did by accident. I'm always conscious that fans of the music I've made over the last 45 years might not have money anymore. Right. They might have medical bills or who knows what's going on. So I always try and come up with an alternate way of doing stuff. So I said, if you don't have $125 for the founder's shirt, you could suggest an item of significance that you want to donate, and maybe that will make you a founder. And it just unlocked the floodgates of people with Paulie Gladden stopped by with 30 T-shirts in two carrier bags. People are sending me stuff. People are becoming founders by buying the shirt and then sending me stuff, then sending me more stuff. It really has exploded outside of my own personal Rolodex, to use that phrase. And the Skinny Puppy area, the Genesis PRH Psychic TV area, Einster Zender Neubauten area, all of these areas are just multiplying under their own steam, it seems.
Well, you bring up something that kind of teed up my next question was, you have been a person who has multiple different interests and talents and stuff, but there's always been seemingly this theme of either teaching, educating, giving back, and collaborating. Obviously, you know, having 600 members of a band, that's a lot of collaboration. Part of what you've done is write a couple books, the Band Smart and Tour Smart. Tell me a little bit about how that came about, and then we'll kind of jump to Columbia College and Milliken.
Well, I'd love to say, and write about 2007, the next piece of my jigsaw puzzle, but it was just, it's all been accidents. But in just to blow my own horn, I think my radar is always on, you know. So I went to Columbia to get some interns to help with some of the tours we were putting together, because we didn't trust promoters to do anything. If they did, it was a pleasant surprise. And we needed people to stuff envelopes and put stickers on things. And so I went to Columbia to get interns. And I know you asked me about the book. I'm getting it. And so I did a little presentation for the staff at Columbia, and somebody said to me, well, when could you start? And I said, well, I can start now. I can take interns to my label now. And they're like, no, when could you start teaching? And I'm like, teaching what? They're like, well, the business of touring. This is what you're doing. I'm like, well, it's what I've done all my life.
Right.
And I thought the crazy, you know, I left school when I was 16. I have my master's degree now. But I just thought the craziest, most punk thing I could do would be to say yes. Uh-huh. And so so I said yes, but I walked into the first class, which was only a few weeks later. And I said, okay, who's got the textbook? And somebody hands me this book written in 1962. And I'm like, what is this? Like, well, this is our textbook. And so my first question was to the students. I'm like, you're paying to be taught touring, which keeps changing, from a book written in 1962? Like, pay attention, you know. If this was a meal, you'd send it back. So I just started to write my own book. And I thought that was a pretty interesting opportunity. It became an Amazon Music Business bestseller. But then I started to get asked to speak all over the world, based on Tour Smart. So, I mean, I found this most unexpected love of teaching, but also teaching is the way that I actually learned about what I was doing.
Thank you again to my guest, Martin Atkins. You've been listening to the State of Sound podcast. For more information, please visit musicfromillinois.com.
This has been the State of Sound podcast produced by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. To hear other episodes and more information about the exhibit, The State of Sound, The World of Music from Illinois, visit musicfromillinois.com.